Hello, this is Playback Daily on Friday, the 21st of March. I'm Louise Herity, and here's some of what's coming up.
The reality is autism is an invisible difference. In our communities across the country, there are people who don't have a diagnosis, and there are people who, you know, don't want to share their experiences. The only way we can build a society that's inclusive is that when we see people, you know, interacting with their world differently, that we accept people as they are.
And I just found the De Niro casting completely gimmicky as well. I don't think there's anything new to say here, and I don't think it says it in a particularly interesting way.
People can be good people and behave badly. And what you have to do in a workplace is call them to task.
Yeah.
And say, you know, you probably don't mean it. I'm sure you don't realise the effects, but these are some of the effects. So this is your chance to change it.
We woke up to the news that the busiest airport in Europe, Heathrow Airport in London, was closed because of a power cut caused by a large fire at a nearby electrical substation. Graeme McQueen, Media Relations Manager at Dublin Airport, spoke to Gavin Jennings on Morning Ireland.
It's a hectic morning, I guess, on the London routes front. All flights to London Heathrow, certainly up until mid-afternoon, have been cancelled by British Airways and Aer Lingus. They're the two carriers who fly between Dublin and London Heathrow. So that equates to about 34 flights, 17 in, 17 out would be a typical day, a typical Friday between London Heathrow and Dublin. So most of those flights, in fact, probably all of those flights aren't going to take off or land at Dublin today. So there's a lot of the first of those flights would have gone at 6:40 this morning, but that didn't take off. So a lot of passengers in the terminals already who weren't aware of the London closure, the Heathrow closure. So they're trying to rebook probably onto other flights going to London. There's lots of other flights to Gatwick, Stansted today as well. So lots of rebooking happening at the moment. And we're waiting to hear, get confirmation from those two airlines as to whether those flights are going to take off later on. But with London Heathrow closed for the day, that seems extremely unlikely.
And what about other flights? Is it having any effect on other flights into and out of Dublin Airport today?
No, everything else is moving well. It's a busy day. Everything to all the other airports is moving fine this morning. It's a busy first wave, but all is good. There could be some knock-on impact over the course of the day, and you know, just due to flights being diverted to other airports, as you mentioned in your intro there, with a lot of activity through the night with planes having to divert to some Irish airports and other airports around Europe because they couldn't get into Heathrow. So that's likely to continue over the course of the day. So passengers should expect some element of disruption. You can get to the airport, Dublin Airport, in normal time, 2 hours before short haul, 3 hours before long haul, but you might expect a little bit of disruption on the network today just due to that Heathrow closure.
Is Dublin accepting any diverted flights?
At the moment, we can't. We're full today, so that notice has been served to the network, so they will be landing. A lot of them went to Shannon overnight. I think Shannon took 7 or 8, and Cork Airport is there as well. So the other airports are busy on that front.
At the moment, the plan is that Heathrow remains closed until midnight tonight, but we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow yet, do we?
No, we don't. And I think passengers due to fly London to Heathrow over the weekend should, you know, be prepared for potential, you know, further cancellations. I think if you can get onto your airline, discuss it with them, whether you can maybe move to one of the other airports in London, because it seems very likely that the knock-on impact will carry on for a number of days on this. Obviously, there will be issues with bags in the network as well. So, you know, there will be some disruption for days to come. So passengers should stay very close to their airlines and make sure that they have the latest information.
Graeme McQueen, Media Relations Manager at Dublin Airport on Morning Ireland. And later, reporter Carol Coleman was at Dublin Airport.
Good morning, Gavin. I'm here at Terminal 1. And despite that big news coming out of London this morning, many passengers bound for Heathrow have turned up here. Some had heard about the closure en route in the taxi, but decided to keep coming anyway to try and change their plans here. Others found out in the queue, literally. I spoke to one couple who didn't know that the flights to Heathrow had been cancelled. So the two airlines that are most affected here are British Airways and Aer Lingus, because they are the ones that fly into London Heathrow. Ryanair is not affected as it goes to Stansted. So what's happening here is that they are trying to get rebooked by those companies on alternative flights. There are flights going to other airports in the UK, and some people have managed to get on those, and others are waiting to see if they can be accommodated. So I spoke to a number of passengers who are here at the airport trying to get home or to their holiday or business destinations.
Headed to Chicago, the flight to Heathrow was cancelled. The flight from Heathrow to the US was cancelled. I'm in limbo until I can find out alternative possibilities.
You're going home after a holiday here?
Yes, my husband and I have been here for a month, so we're trying to get back.
So you're prepared for a long day?
Oh, yes. We'll figure out what else we can do in Dublin.
Yeah, actually, I came from Canada and I was going to Heathrow, but actually I'm going north to Nottingham, so I'm going to reroute to Birmingham and I might get there around the same time, so not too bad for me.
It is unusual to see Heathrow Airport closed for an entire day.
Yeah, shocking. I fly there all the time and I've never seen that happen before, and it's massive disruption, I'm sure, for a lot of people.
Yeah, our flight has been cancelled. We're exchange students and right now we're going to London to do a tourist trip.
Everybody tired? Where did you come from?
Argentina.
So you flew in from Argentina and now you're stuck here?
Yes.
Oh, so are you tired?
Yes.
Do you think you'll get there soon?
We hope so.
Yeah.
And how long was the flight from Argentina?
Like 12 hours, yes.
You must be exhausted.
We are. We are.
How are you inconvenienced this morning?
Just trying to get back home now by any means. But I booked a flight for this afternoon to go to Southampton. But yeah, it would have been nice to have got home, but I live actually about an hour from Southampton, but I've got to sit at the airport for 7 hours before it can go, so it's going to be a bit chaotic today.
So I was going to London Heathrow this morning with my friend to see two plays in London this weekend, but I have to say, give credit to Aer Lingus, they were super helpful, and we've been rebooked to Manchester today, and hopefully Heathrow will be open on Sunday and we can get back to Dublin.
Woke up this morning at 3 o'clock to the headline, Heathrow closed, and I thought, oh my God, heart attack, I have a wedding in New York tomorrow. But just got in the car anyway from Enniskillen and was in this queue to see what might happen. The heavens helped me and I got an email to say we've rebooked you on the direct Aer Lingus flight, so I am happy out.
You're going to make that wedding.
I'm going to make that wedding.
It's an important one.
And he's the father of the groom.
Oh, best of luck.
And I'm his godmother.
Oh, best of luck.
Stall that wedding. Carol, so how long is this disruption going to last?
It's going to last all day, Gavin, and beyond. Two flights in the next hour are cancelled, and looking up at the board, that you can see that every flight to London Heathrow is now showing up red and cancelled. 17 flights, according to Graham McQueen of the Dublin Airport Authority, 17 flights in and 17 flights out will be affected. Now, they are telling everybody else to come to the airport as normal. So if you're going on a short-haul flight, 2 hours, three for your long-haul flight. But they are warning people to expect further knock-on cancellations as this problem works its way through the system today and possibly for the coming days.
Carol, thank you. That's our reporter, Carol Coleman, at Dublin Airport. Let's go to the Midwest, to Shannon Airport. The CEO, Mary Considine, is on the line. Morning, Mary.
Good morning, Gavin.
Many people who are expecting to be in London this morning are in County Clare, I gather.
Well, I suppose, as you've heard there in Carol's interview already, the Heathrow flights are being impacted, but everything else is operating as normal. And indeed, earlier this morning, our team in the airport took a number of flight diversions from transatlantic carriers, British Airways, United and Virgin, who were already en route from the US into Heathrow, and they diverted into Shannon. So the first of those flights arrived at 4:26, and the last of those arrived just before 5:40 this morning. So we're helping those passengers through and they're being reaccommodated by the airline. So yes, a lot of activity this morning in Shannon.
Are you expecting any more diverted flights to Shannon today?
Well, I suppose it is an evolving situation and the airlines are grappling with it. I think those particular ones that were already en route, obviously diverted in, airlines then subsequent to that were making decisions to turn back or change routing. So, you know, we will monitor it throughout the day.
What's your advice then to people who are on their way to the airport today or who have flights planned from Shannon to London?
Well, I think anyone planning to travel to London today with Aer Lingus, Ryanair are operating as normal, but the Heathrow flights, I think they should contact their airline, and everything else is operating as normal. So they should come to the airport as normal for everything else, but contact Aer Lingus in relation to the Heathrow flights today.
Heathrow are hoping that everything will be back up and running by the end of today. They've cancelled flights until midnight tonight. How long do you expect this disruption to last for you?
Well, I imagine there will be a knock on, but we are hoping that, you know, things will be back up and operating as quickly as possible. And I know Aer Lingus are making contact directly with airlines to try and rebook them or offer alternative routings. But it's too early to say.
A lot of people asking the question in London this morning, how Heathrow Airport was brought to the close by this fire at a substation, why there wasn't backup. What would be the plan if there was a fire affecting Shannon in this way?
Well, I suppose as part of our contingency planning, we would be working very closely, and we do with the ESB around backup power lines into the airport. And ordinarily, you know, if you have a power dip, as we've had in the past, your generators kick in, so it shouldn't impact on operations. But obviously, I don't know the specifics of this, so it wouldn't be appropriate to comment.
Mary Considine, CEO of Shannon Airport, chatting to Gavin Jennings on Morning Ireland. We were getting updates throughout the morning about the situation at Heathrow, and later on today with Claire Byrne, we heard from travel correspondent for the London Independent, Simon Calder.
Oh my goodness, Claire, it's been absolutely awful. So the fire started about 10 hours ago at midnight, and it was 3 a.m. when Heathrow made the call, we are going to close for the day. We simply haven't got any power. And of course, they depend absolutely crucially on power in order to get everything from the runway lights to the IT systems working. So that didn't happen. And they just said, we're cancelling everything. By that stage, exactly as you say, there were 120 aircraft in flight going to Heathrow Airport. And well, yeah, if anybody's lucky enough to be in beautiful Shannon this morning, they will see that there's aircraft from British Airways, United Airlines, and quite possibly a few more on the ground there. They were basically put there because it's the first bit of Europe that you get to, and they simply stopped there and decided to go no further. Mm-hmm. Of course, dozens and dozens of flights between Irish airports and the UK. And as a result of that, well, there's just thousands of people stranded. And more particularly, I guess, people with plans for the weekend have no idea if and when they will be able to get on their way.
Mm-hmm. Now, people will be looking at this. Obviously, this was a substantial fire. Anyone who has seen the pictures will know that. It's under control now, we understand from reports that are coming in. But people will be saying, well, why doesn't Heathrow have alternative backup power plans? Is it just too big to have those in place?
Well, of course, no. It's not too big to fail, as we've most definitely seen. The big problem is that and clearly this is absolutely critical infrastructure, the most important bit of infrastructure, I think, in the whole of Europe, probably in terms of transport. And if it's not working, well, that just completely wrecks the schedules of a quarter of a million people today, possibly more than that tomorrow. And it will remain to be seen if things are going to get back to anything like normal by the start of next week.
Mm-hmm. And that seems to be the prediction. And does that fit with what you're hearing, that this is going to be days, Simon, before there is a return to normal?
Well, okay, so we know that Heathrow is working very, very hard on trying to get this fixed. The National Grid in the UK is obviously doing what it can in order to try to get things all the power switched back on. But even when it is, if you take an airline like British Airways, the main operator at Heathrow, well, all of its planes are out of position. Not all of them, of course, they've got a fair number which just didn't go anywhere this morning, but lots of planes, lots of pilots, lots of cabin crew just in the wrong places, and it's very difficult to see how they can get to anything, back to anything like normal anytime soon. It's a miserable position for them, their staff, and more particularly for all their passengers.
And listen, the airlines we know are scrambling. I mean, I see EasyJet now, Ryanair saying we're going to put on as many extra flights as we can. We're putting bigger planes on the routes, but they're still working this out, you know, how they're going to get, how to, they're going to move people around. The advice for people is to get in touch with those airlines and not, of course, to travel to Heathrow or to the airport you plan to leave from to get to Heathrow.
Yeah, and sure. And the British Transport Secretary, Heidi Alexander, has said, I advise you to contact the airlines. But I mean, anybody who thinks that they're going to get a sensible answer out of British Airways today is mistaken, because the airline is obviously just completely overwrought. It didn't even get the cancellation notices out until 6 o'clock in the morning, by which stage many people will have been on their way to the airport. So it's just a matter of waiting. I've got a booking on BA this afternoon. They just said, you know, keep an eye on your emails and texts, which isn't much use to anybody.
And there's no possibility that you're hearing about that Heathrow could open sooner than midnight.
Right. OK, well, I'm hoping that the cancellation until so late was done out of an abundance of caution. And they thought, OK, the thing to do is to close everything, even though, yeah, we might have stuff back and running by this afternoon. I'm very much hoping that is the case. But Heathrow was saying, nope, the disruption could stretch for days. And Ryanair, of course, and as well EasyJet of the UK will be delighted that they don't have anything to do with Heathrow. They are picking up extra bookings and indeed putting on extra flights in order to try to help people out. And I imagine those will go quite soon, and they may even come up with some more.
Travel correspondent Simon Calder on Today with Claire Byrne, and reporter Maura Fay was at Dublin Airport.
I can see cancelled written across the screen here in lots of spots on the flight's departure screen, Claire. The advice to people now is do not come to the airport. Contact your airline directly and they will try to reschedule. But as you can imagine, Claire, this situation is causing an awful lot of hassle for people, particularly those in larger groups. I was speaking to one lady from Argentina a short time ago. She's the leader of a group of 20 17-year-old Argentinian students who spent the last 2 weeks in Ireland learning English. Now, they were due to fly from Dublin to London this morning for a 3-day excursion and then from there back to Argentina. However, that's not happening now, and they can't break up into smaller groups to go on different flights to get to London, as the students are all minors and need to be accompanied by adults. She's now in the process of trying to book a hotel for tonight and get flights that will bring the group to London in advance of their return flight to Argentina early next week. So obviously a lot of stress there. Another group I spoke to, a group of 8 people, they were due to fly from Cork this morning to Miami via Heathrow. However, those flights obviously got cancelled. They then booked flights direct from Dublin to Miami, so got on the road at 5:30 this morning and made it just in time for their flights. But a lot of stress there, and obviously an enormous expense, Claire.
Okay, and Maura, you mentioned there the advice is not to come to Dublin Airport, but that's for people specifically who had plans to travel on to Heathrow. Everybody else will get their flight as normal. Is that right?
Yes, everyone who is, all other flights to other destinations are operating normally, and there's no disruption or anything like that in that regard here.
Okay, but if you are travelling to Heathrow, if that was your plan, Heathrow is closed and you shouldn't travel to Dublin Airport in those circumstances.
Yes, correct.
Maura Fay reporting from Dublin Airport on Today with Claire Byrne. Aside from the chaos at Heathrow Airport, there was loads more happening on the radio today. And on Oliver Callum, we heard about the ballet class for the over 55s. Emma Mahoney spoke to Oliver about her class, Silver Swans Ballet.
So Silver Swans is a ballet class, and it's accessible for anyone over the age of 55. And it's a full ballet class, so you get that feeling of being, you know, really elegant, being a ballerina,
yes.
But it's safe, you know, it's safe for older bodies.
Very good. So it's a ballet program for people over the age of 55. Where does it happen?
So I teach in Baldoyle and Kilbarrack, so in North Dublin, and also in town in the city centre in Dance House.
When you started this, who came, how many people were in your first class?
So I first started back in 2017 with just three students.
Okay.
And we were all kind of starting out fresh. Three very different people, like some one person had danced when she was younger quite extensively, and then the other two are complete beginners. And that's carried through all the way. So even now, it's a really big mix in the classes of some people who danced a lot, others not at all, and then some in between. And it's great that everyone can just come together and dance.
So from three people in one class, how is it going now?
Oh, well, it's just fabulous. Since then, it's just grown and grown. And it's so positive to see the response it's gotten. It's amazing. There's such a want of people to dance. So at the moment, I teach over 80 students a week.
80 Silver Swans.
Yes.
Seven classes a week. It's great. Obviously, people would think, oh, no, I wouldn't have the I wouldn't be able to bend and stretch. And can you come in as a complete beginner?
You can come in as a complete beginner with two hip replacements and dodgy knees. You know, you can come in exactly as you are.
Yeah.
And that's where what my job and my passion is, to make ballet accessible for every single learner. And you can adapt anything. You know, you take the essence of the step, the thing, you know, that makes it beautiful, and then you just change and you tweak it until everybody can do some version of it.
Okay, so they'll end up doing some version of the plié.
Yeah.
Holding themselves up or whatever, or the walks.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I might say it's very elegant. Is it all women that's coming to you at the moment?
At the moment it is, yeah. There's no reason why it should be. But yeah, the moment it's a group of just 80 brilliant women. And it's really nice when everyone comes, when you're teaching adults, they all come with their own life experience and their own stories. And it's just a really fabulous group of people.
Well, there's a very happy silver swan on the line. Liz Piggott-Lynn, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me on.
No, thank you very much. You, I think, joined the Swans about 5 years ago. Is that right?
I did. I joined, actually, my father passed away and I wanted to do something really nice that would remind, just for him. And Saturday morning, which was my time for being with Dad, I found Silver Swans. I found Emma's Silver Swans. And I haven't looked back since then.
That's lovely, because you spent Saturdays caring for your dad. It was obviously a gap in the week if you weren't going. And now you're doing ballet.
Yeah. Now I am doing ballet. And I'm doing it several times a week. So I've gone from not doing it. I never did it as a child. I was more of a tomboy and out kicking football and playing rugby, to being a little ballerina now. Visions of a little ballerina. I'm not sure that I really make that. But
are you
I'm
fitter?
Trying.
You're fitter now, I'd say.
I would say that I would be more supple, strength, bone strength, muscle strength, how I hold myself. I would say all of that has improved.
Oh, my God. The way you speak, I presume, has changed, because you sound like you actually sound like a ballet dancer. Like, it's brilliant. Thank you so much, Liz Piggott-Lynn. Enjoy your Saturday morning tomorrow, and Emma Mahoney as well. And the Silver Swans programme is at the Odette School of Ballet with Dance Ireland, the Odette School of Ballet.ie, O-D-E-T-T-E, the Odette School of Ballet.ie.
As heard on Oliver Callan today. As always on a Friday, we look ahead to what's on in the cinema, and Tara Brady and Declan Burke were the movie reviewers on Arena last night. Two of the choices, De Niro versus De Niro and A Woke Princess in Distress. Here they are with Kay Sheehy.
So, Tara, we're on to Alto Nights now. This gives us two Robert De Niros for the price of one. Could you set this up? It's a gangster story,
yes.
And it's set in the 1950s.
So it's a true life gangster story. And if you don't know it's true life, you will recognise that it is by the fact that there's this barrage of narration from the moment you sit down, and 40 minutes in, we're still getting all this kind of explanations. We get straight to camera narration. We get voiceover. We get bits of archive footage. We get the camera pointed at news stories, radio stories, and TV stories in order to keep explaining what's going on and explaining the people we're looking at. And then we have Robert De Niro under a lot of prosthetics, playing dual roles as Frank Costello and Vito Genovese, who are two Italian American associates, I suppose we could call them, and they're battling for control of the Luciano crime syndicates in the 1950s in New York. So the way the film sets it up is it's a bit of a dubious distinction. I think most people will agree, that Costello is the gentleman mobster. You know, he runs, you know, sort of guns and liquor and rackets and clubs and all that, and then the Vito is the kind of more hot-headed one, and he wants to get into the drug trade. So it kind of sets up that distinction, which is something that you very often find in mob films.
Both from poverty-stricken background in Italy.
Well, no. they're both New Yorkers, so that's really this. It's completely focused on this kind of New York story. Vito becomes this kind of king abroad because he's, you know, avoiding doing time in America, and he ends up in Italy during World War II. And then when he comes back, there's this huge battle for control of territory in New York because he wants a bigger piece of the pie.
So of course there has to be a scene where both De Niro's meet each other. And here we have him in the dual role in a scene with himself as mob boss Vito and Frank Costello.
You're going down a very dangerous road. You know that. We ain't been down dangerous roads before. All of a sudden, we can't go down dangerous roads. This is a road that I'm not going down because you're going to take us all down. This is not the way. You know, it's just a matter of time you're going to get pinched. But don't forget, you're a racketeer. You're a gangster. Come on. All of a sudden, you want to be half in, half out, half a racketeer. You can't have it both ways. You're either in or you're out. And whether you're half in or half out, that don't mean you ain't going to get caught the same way I could get caught or I could go down. It's the same thing. Come on, don't be naive. We don't control this. Somebody else does it.
This is a death sentence. It's a big, big mistake.
Look, you do what you want. You want to be a diplomat, that's your business. Me? I'm a gangster. I'm a racketeer. That's it. That's it. That's the life.
So, Declan, they don't sound that different. Do they look very different? Is there confusion?
There is no visual confusion. There's quite a bit of prosthetics involved with the character of Vito Genovese. So, yeah, you're never in any doubt as to which is which. And there's very much the idea of one is yin and yang, and as Tara says, that tired old trope of, you know, the good mobster versus the vicious, which is a whole pile of nonsense, unfortunately. I think that De Niro does relatively well given the circumstances. I'm not sure why they had to cast two De Niros, but in the circumstances, I think he does relatively well. Look, he's been playing this part or a variation on it for the best part of 50 years, so he's completely comfortable in it.
And are there prosthetics to make them look different?
Yeah, I think Vito has a slightly sharper, more bulbous nose, and it's so that the Frank Costello character is portrayed as being more comfortable and more relaxed in himself because he is, you know, he's a charitable type and he's a patron of all these wonderful organisations, whereas the character of Vito is portrayed as much more narrow and insular, and he is paranoid and he's vicious and so forth. So there's no issue visually with the discrimination between them. My issue, in similar to Tara, is that this idea of, you know, the two boys who grew up in the hardscrabble streets of New York and experienced poverty, as you suggested, and they go their different paths. Their paths were not that different in real life. And I think, to a large extent, it feels as if there is a distinction made by Barry Levinson and Nicholas Pileggi, who wrote Goodfellas and has been writing this kind of story, you know, for the best part of 30 or 40 years. They're trying to state that there's more of a difference between these two characters than there actually was in real life.
All right. So do you think there's anything new in this from the gangster genre, given all the developments that there has been, even since Goodfellas, because we've had The Sopranos, we've had so many fantastic views of the gangster life?
No, I mean, even if this had come out right after Goodfellas, it would have felt like a kind of a tired old story. It doesn't. There are, like, you know, Pileggi can write a really good scene, and there's a couple of really nice very post-soprano scenes. There's a lovely heated exchange when they're all driving along the road, and there's a fight about where the Mormons were from in the States. And there's a couple of very, very well-written scenes like that. But the film itself doesn't really hold together. Structurally, it's an absolute mess. You end up with a lot of repetition, and for all the explanation, like I was saying to you, the way it's stacked up at the beginning, you're sort of sitting there for 40 minutes and waiting for the film to start. Well, when are people going to just stop explaining what's going on here and actually get into a scene, or because that would or a story? That's a problem. I just found the De Niro casting completely gimmicky as well. I don't think there's anything new to say here, and I don't think it says it in a particularly interesting way.
What about supporting cast, Declan? Deborah Messing plays one of their wife, and then Catherine Narducci plays the other wife.
She plays Vito's partner at one stage in his career, we can say they co-star. They're not on screen enough really to make any kind of worthwhile impression, which is a pity, because I think both Deborah Messing and Catherine Narducci, and particularly Catherine Narducci, she's a force of nature when she's on screen, and suddenly there's a whole different dynamic in the story. It's not just about De Niro on De Niro. So I personally could have done a lot more with both of those. Deborah Messing, maybe a little less so, but she has a kind of a controlling... not a controlling in a negative sense, but she has she can exert a little control on the character of Frank Costello. Not enough of them, basically, is what I'm trying to say.
Okay, stars out of five from you, Tara, for Alto Nights.
It's two, I'm afraid.
Okay, Declan?
Yeah, I'm going to give two stars for each De Niro.
Would that be four out of five?
It is a four out of five. It is a tired, and it's a retread of the classic mobster shows, but it's De Niro being kind of peak, not quite peak De Niro, but it's doing classic De Niro.
With two very distinctive characters.
Yeah, and I think if you're a De Niro fan, I think you will get bang for your buck.
Which
here.
You obviously are, Tara.
Which I am.
Mm-hmm. Less mm-hmm. so. Okay, our final film tonight sees Disney returning to one of the stories that made the studio famous, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. It was originally released in 1937, and here we have a new version simply called Snow White. Would it be fair to say the film has attracted lots of attention, Declan?
Well, obviously it has, and not necessarily for the right reasons. There's been huge issues about, so Rachel Zegler, for example, being cast as Snow White when she's Colombian, for example, which is a whole load of nonsense as far as I'm concerned. It's been criticised for being too woke, because the Seven Dwarfs can no longer be called dwarfs, which is fair enough if that's what people don't want to be called. I have no issue with that. But there's been a lot of negativity in advance of this, and the fact that Gal Gadot and Rachel Zegler have both made fairly high-profile pronouncements on the war in Gaza hasn't helped it at this point so far. In terms of the story itself, if we can concentrate on the film, they try and remake a classic animated film in 2025 when the elements that worked in 1937 simply don't work anymore. And I say that as someone who's a big fan of the Disney animated movies, and particularly the princess movies, because I have a young daughter and she came through that whole arc and I was totally on board with most of it. You can make a live action remake of a Disney animated classic well, as was the case with Beauty and the Beast, or you can make an absolute dog's dinner of it, as was the case with Pinocchio. This isn't quite as bad as Pinocchio, but it's nowhere as good as Beauty and the Beast.
Tara?
Yeah, this is a mess. So we end up with this Snow White who's living in a kingdom, and it's a monarchy, but it also seems to be some kind of communist monarchy where the royals go and bake apple pies, which just makes you think of something Marie Antoinette didn't say, let them eat pie. But none of it adds up, and then it becomes a little bit Robin Hood, and then they're having some kind of revolution, and the revolution is to give the monarchy back to the monarch, but also to the people, and so politically it's a complete mess. mess. It's a complete jumble. But the biggest problem for me, and it's a huge problem visually, is the decision to have, you've got a live action cast, and then the dwarf characters are cartoons. So they're given the same treatment as like the cutesy woodland critters. And whoever thought that was a good idea or that it was going to play well on screen, it A, takes you out of the movie, and it's also incredibly offensive. It just doesn't work at all.
I think at the centre of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, or Snow White in this case, is that aggression between the new queen and the princess. How does that work between the evil stepmother Snow White?
It's set up in classic fashion. Gal Gadot plays the evil stepmother who has usurped Snow White's father's throne. And of course, she has the magic mirror, and it's mirror on the wall, and who's the fairest of them all. And eventually the mirror announces that Snow White is fairer than the beautiful queen. And that's when Snow White has to go. And that's all pretty standard stuff. And, you know, they do that quite well, except the evil queen is a plum role. I mean, how can you not play that well? All you have to do is ham it up, chew the scenery.
Yes, overdo it. Yeah.
And I thought Gal Gadot was incredibly flat the whole way through this film. I couldn't believe in her. I mean, I know it's a fairy tale, but I simply couldn't believe in the character.
Tara, did you agree?
Oh yeah, no. I think it's about. I think almost all of the characters around Snow, and it's, you know, the sad thing is that like Rachel Zegler has been attacked repeatedly in the run up to this film, and she's the best thing in the movie by far. But like everyone else is little. I mean, and it's not always the actor's fault. I think like the love interest, who's no longer a prince, but you know is the kind of Robin Wood character, a Robin Hood character, Jonathan, played by Andrew Burnup. Like he's so dull. I mean, it's such a dull role, and like the guy's singing his heart out, and for what?
Okay, this doesn't sound good. So stars from you, Declan, for Snow White.
Yeah, as Tara says, Rachel Zegler is very good, and on the strength of that, I'm going to give this 3 out of 5.
And from you, Tara?
Oh, I can't go beyond 2. I'm afraid
2.
No.
Okay.
Tara Brady and Declan Burke on Arena with Kay Sheehy. On Today with Claire Byrne, we got some advice on dealing with an aggressive boss. Claire was joined by workplace psychologist Patricia Murray.
Who are we talking about here when we're talking about angry bosses? What is the stereotype description?
Stereotypes I try to avoid, but I suppose the stereotype, first of all, we've already said, is a boss. So someone who already has power and someone who carries a lot of weight on their shoulders, or believes they do, and maybe they do. And often they're in jobs that are quite busy and juggling a good few things. Now, predictors of aggressive behaviour often come from the person themselves and their background rather than the job. But there are a few job predictors, like being very busy, juggling a lot of things, having a good few people to manage, and being, to be honest, out of their depth.
Mm-hmm. So which makes you wonder how they got to the position of power in the first place.
Exactly. And often they got to the position of power through a mixture of things, being good at something. Let's be honest, we can't tar them with the brush of being bad at everything. They're bad at human relations if they're shouting and swearing at people they work with. But they might be very good engineers or doctors or lawyers or whatever it may be.
Mm-hmm.
But they're just not used to dealing with their own frustrations. One of the real things we look at when we look at people who are successful, psychological literature says, whether they're successful in terms of gaining money or just being happy, is having good insight into their own emotions and being good at managing and processing their own emotions. So not delivering the emotion onto
Trisha,
others.
Can it be the case that somebody who rules with an iron fist can be seen as somebody who's good at getting things done?
Of course. I mean, I have a lot of examples, I suppose, in the public and political sphere at the moment of some of those characters. And they can be seen as, and of course, it's quite reflective. Again, it's nuanced, because in society then tells those people, you're powerful, you're getting things done. And they then tell society, I'm powerful, I'm getting things done. And they interpret, the reason I get things done is because I'm tough, I'm like this. And they almost see, they narrate it as, I'm like this because this makes me able. Mm-hmm. It makes me capable. And those of you who don't, as they might say, talk straight, you don't really quite have what I've got. And a lot of these people think they're like man of the people or woman of the people, and they speak the truth. And it's just, they kind of reframe it as, authentic and real and upfront, when really it's rude and aggressive and malignant.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't be tolerated.
And it's horrible to be in the presence of that person and to be working for them. So how do you deal with it if that's your boss?
It's a difficult one. And I've seen it both in my previous job and in certain work I do now. Out there, like in companies, and you know, it's very difficult for HR people. Like, I've had HR people saying, we'd like to do something, but like the management here won't do it because this person is very good at X or Y or Z and bottom line stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I've actually seen emails from senior managers to each other acknowledging that they know this, but still, what can we do? So I think really what you have to look at is, first of all, the people who are working for these people are very exposed, and they're exposed to a hazard. So you have to do something to minimise it. Either A, you're going to encourage general training on proper behaviour, and this might nudge them. Or else you're going to encourage coaching and say, we're going to actually call this out, Pat or Mick or whatever. The behaviour isn't acceptable. I heard you shouting like that. OK, always maybe once off you can let something go, but it's not acceptable here. We're going to get you coaching or mentoring. And that can do something. But ultimately, the social norm that's established in a workplace either reinforces and allows certain behaviours or it extinguishes it. Mm-hmm. And we know from research as well that a person might be predisposed towards a behaviour. They might get away with it in a previous job and at home. But if suddenly it's not accepted, and even by what people do, even how they look, if someone looks at them astonished, moves away, talks to somebody else and just says, oh, OK, and says something, they might realise, oops, I've misstepped here. And that's good too. So social norms allow people or else stop people doing things.
Mm-hmm. And for somebody, again, who's working for someone like that, it can be really difficult day to day if you're facing that every day in the office, and really difficult not to bring it home with you, you know?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Surely there must come a time where you would be advising somebody, look, the best option for you here is to get out.
There have been times where that would be the case, and colleagues of mine who work in career coaching would tell me the same thing, psychologists who work in different areas to myself. And in the end of the day, you have to say to yourself, what's best for this person? If they're really struggling, you would end up saying, look elsewhere in the company, or if you've, as often happens, people lose faith in that company and they therefore want to just not be part of the company, which is unfortunate for the company.
Mm-hmm.
So you say move on, which is really difficult. And companies out there listening, you know, take heed, keep an eye out, and if you see something, easier to nip it in the bud early than have people leave and a contagion effects then when people leave when there's even nothing going on.
But if you are trying to manage this upward and trying to let it be known that this person is not behaving appropriately, what are your top tips in terms of having meetings and interactions with that person?
Yeah, I would always think try and have two people there if you can without making it obvious to the person. Keep the door open if you can. These people often say they've open door policies, and they often then bring everyone to lunch a few weeks later. They do nice things afterwards to make up for it, but no one ever names it. So it's always good to name it in a nicer way. Oh, I was a bit nervous there last week. I thought something must have happened to you, and then move on to something else. So you've kind of brought it up without making them answer for it.
Mm-hmm.
Have two people there. Discuss it with a few colleagues and see what they think in a nice enough way. And then if you need to go to HR and say, I'm telling you something here because I think it's bad for X or Y. Be very careful of new recruits too, because I had somebody who was behaving in an aggressive way, a new recruit was afraid. And when I broached it with the person, I said, you know, this has happened. They were mortified and said, I feel so embarrassed. I was actually a nervous pupil in school. And the last thing I want is for a new recruit to feel nervous of me. The gang here all know me and they know I do this and I don't mean it. And I had to say, it's not really like that anymore. You can't really do that.
That's a warning sign if someone's saying that everyone knows what I'm like and they accept it.
Yeah. And the thing is, we can't make all of these people bad people. I mean, people can be good people and behave badly. And what you have to do in a workplace is call them to task.
Yeah.
And say, you know, you probably don't mean it. I'm sure you don't realise the effects, but these are some of the effects. So this is your chance to change it. And we'll give you a bit of a hand and we'll come back to you in a month. And, you know, assume the best.
Yeah.
Workplace psychologist Patricia Murray on Today with Claire Byrne. Adam Harris, the founder and CEO of As I Am, Ireland's autism charity, was this week's visiting critic on Oliver Callan's show.
Now, what discomfort zone did we send Adam to review for you? We sent him to experience sound bathing. Do we know how to describe this yet? I think it's a something like an immersive experience with tones, waves and resonances of sounds. We're playing with all sorts of synonyms this morning.
Well, I have to be honest, when I was asked to do one by your team, I'd never heard of it before. So it was definitely a new experience and definitely something that I think you need to describe and visualise, because it wasn't what I even visualised when I showed up yesterday. I think I imagined maybe sitting on the floor in a studio and maybe some chanting or some light background music.
Yeah.
But I went into the room and met a fantastic practitioner called Karen, who was running the session. It was a little bit like a therapy room. There was two seats, a coffee table, and then there was kind of a raised bed in the centre of the room. Right. And initially you had a conversation. She was really good. She kind of explained what to expect, what the session would involve. And then you're invited to lay on the bed. Yeah. And they place a blanket over you. And then there was some background music playing and that was turned off. And then, you know,
is it kind of yoga relaxing music?
Yeah, very kind of Eastern influence kind of music.
Oh,
and when I, you know, you're encouraged to close your eyes and apparently a lot of people fall asleep or just relax. I knew, like, getting up on the gurney, that I'm not someone who can just think of nothing. So I knew
especially
that wasn't going to
be a gurney.
Exactly. That wasn't going to happen for me. So then what proceeds to happen is the practitioner continues to walk very, very slowly around the bed over the course of 1 hour.
Nice, yeah.
With a variety of different instruments. And it's strange because a lot of the time you're trying to keep your eyes closed, so you can't always see what they're holding. And I suppose it is...
Try to catch a sneaky look.
Yeah, you do. When you open your eyes, sometimes you see, gosh, that person has a big hammer in the air. I think I'll close my eyes. This is a bit scary. And, you know, they're ringing different kind of chimes and bells, but really kind of had nearly like a cymbal you'd see off a drum, and they were hitting it with a hammer.
Oh, my gosh.
But slowly moving it across your body, up your body and around your head. Certainly for the first 20, 30 minutes, those noises at times were, they were nearly like a funny frequency on a radio. Or that sensation whereby, you know, when you're on a flight and your ears pop and it's like the sound is skewed some way. So as a sound sensitive person, I mean, I wasn't loving that bit, but there was elements of it that were really nice. One of the more unusual things was about, I'd say, 3/4 of the way through the session, a large bowl, a really heavy bowl, nearly shaped like an urn or something, a pestle and mortar, is placed kind of on the small of your chest. And they begin to essentially rub the kind of trumpet thing around it. And it feels like the sound is in your body. So it's a really...
The vibrations go through
deep
you.
Deep pressure kind of thing. And
that's an interesting experience.
That was really nice. And I suppose I wasn't able to sit still, so I found myself tossing and turning.
There's no way you were going to fall asleep.
No, I spotted a clock towards the end of the session. I was glad I didn't see that at the start, because one of the things that really stayed with me was you've no idea how long an hour is doing nothing. Like, I'm someone who's constantly scrolling on my phone.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was really strange to just do nothing, think of nothing and have this experience for an hour. So they finished up with some light chimes then and had a nice chat with Karen after. And she was explaining that, you know, often people say they have experiences, so maybe they go back to happy memories and so on. I just said, you know, I found it really kind of an interesting experience. It was, again, kind of interesting to try and think of nothing and fail for an hour.
Couldn't switch off.
No, but when
Was it the clock? Did the clock suddenly go, oh, I've got this appointment, I must...
No, I think it's really hard to think of nothing, isn't it? Like, going to sleep at night, I'd always have something like on in the background, like a podcast that you can kind of zone into. But I suppose it was that sense of nothing to concentrate on, in a sense, except these noises, some of which were quite overpowering and some of which were relaxing. But you're still very kind of conscious the whole time, I found. But then when I went up Nassau Street afterwards, I did feel completely dazed. So it does have some sort of an impact. And I did sleep particularly well last night.
Interesting.
Don't know, was that a hard day's work or the experience? But I think we'll give it to Karen that it was something in it.
So because you did this on a working day, you just had come from work.
Dressed in my work clothes. So I didn't exactly look like I was going to enter a new dimension or something. But
I wouldn't say many suited people go for a sound bath.
No, I wouldn't think so. And I think you can do a sound bath in a class. So I don't know how it would be structured in that sense. Intense because it was one to one, I suppose.
Yeah, that would be, you'd be hearing all the other sound. That might be a little bit too much. When we contacted you and said, look, this is a slot where you get out of your comfort zone, I think we initially suggested the two things you said, sport and music.
Yes.
That you're not terribly interested in.
Exactly. I think, you know, outside of the work that I do, we often joke that, you know, anything that happened in the last 200 years, I'm not much used to, because I love history and things like that. I was funny, you know, I think we talked about maybe me doing a GA training session or
that
a yoga class.
So idea.
I tried to pick the activity that preserved my dignity the most.
So it was more in the music end of things. And it did sound like it was going to be a difficult one, didn't it? Sound bathing, because...
Yeah, I definitely. And I think I went into it not knowing kind of what to expect at all. But certainly as the session went on, there was elements of it that would definitely be uncomfortable for someone who's sensory sensitive.
Yeah.
And then there was elements that were really interesting. So it's off the bucket list, but it was worth doing, I think.
Would you do it again?
I don't know. Again, if I take something from it, I think it is interesting to just try and have some disconnect time. I don't think you can disconnect from everything, but from just kind of sitting, scrolling on your phone. That's a really alien experience. So I thought that was my main takeaway from yesterday.
I like to think if it depends on what you're scrolling on your phone.
Well, that's true.
So you go, oh, no, this is highbrow content.
I think it's usually not.
Someone said sound baths are fantastic. It's the most wonderful way to finish the week and start the weekend. That's from Breed. I mean, that's kind of the experience you had from you slept well.
I think it was really positive. And again, I would just praise if people were interested in experiencing it, the Dublin Wellbeing Centre, they were really good. And, you know, I don't know if they knew I was an autistic person or not, but even they were very kind in terms of explaining what the session was going to involve, talking through the different tools, you know, letting me know if anything's uncomfortable. So, you know, I think if someone wants to dip their toe in the water, definitely that's a place
very
to try.
Good. And you, if you're having a sensory experience like that, you would need to know in advance particularly what's happening.
I think we would often encourage, I think certainly for our community, as much predictability as possible is really important.
So, everything,
you know, from seeing the environment to knowing what the sensory surroundings are going to be like.
There's going to be a vibrating bowl on the chest.
Exactly, that's always useful.
That's for everybody to know, but particularly for the community. How are you at comfort zones? What are you most comfortable doing then? Is it literally sitting down, reading? Is that what you do for your downtime?
Yeah, so like there's probably a few things I like to do when I'm off. Reading is probably one of my favourite things. I enjoy walking and listening to podcasts. A couple of summers ago, I went through a really intense period where I walked home every night from Blackrock to the city centre. Didn't get to do that last summer, but really enjoyed...
Every day?
Yeah, really enjoyed that kind of movement and just kind
of... How long does that take?
It used to take about an hour and a half. About an hour and a half, yeah.
That must have been brilliant for fitness.
It was really good. So probably should get back at that at some stage. And then the other thing was I love making Lego. I have a few really nice pieces at home, like a Lego typewriter and the Taj Mahal. And I'm working on Notre Dame at the minute. So that's a little thing I like to
do. I looked up in the Notre Dame one. Is it 4,000 pieces? Is that the one you're doing?
Yeah, exactly. You don't want to stand on it.
They come with the big Bible-sized books of instructions.
Huge and loads of bags. And yeah, exactly.
When did you get that?
I got it for Christmas. So we're making slow progress. You know, it took 1,000 years to build. So I think hopefully we'll get the Lego set made a bit quicker than that.
As long as it doesn't get burned down.
Exactly.
Halfway through. Because you don't have a lot of free time, because As I Am keeps you very busy.
As I Am is really intense. So I've been leading As I Am for the last 11 years now, and we're Ireland's autism charity. And I suppose we provide supports both directly to autistic people, but also place a huge emphasis on trying to make society more accessible. I suppose we've become more aware of autism than ever before, but that doesn't mean we really understand or accept it. So while autism in a nutshell might be a hard thing for listeners to get their head around, in As I Am, what we try and explain really simply is that doesn't everyone in society deserve the same chance? Mm. And autistic people at present don't receive that, whether it's access to school, access to services, but making friends, participating in community activities. We face barriers, others don't. And in As I Am, we're trying to make those barriers visible and knock them down.
I mean, we've had this conversation only recently. Rady Pete and Dan Lambert were talking about the access for kids early on, and they mentioned As I Am and the support they got. In terms of your working week then, what do you do from day to day? Are you around the country or do you base yourself in an office?
So we're based in Blackrock in County Dublin, but one of the things we're really excited about at the moment is we're opening a new model of support called a one-stop shop, which are going to be regional hubs to support the community. So we're about to open one in Dublin and one in Galway and have ambitions to spread those. But I suppose my week, what really is interesting about it is obviously being autistic is a whole of life experience, and there's no aspect of society we don't need to make more accessible. So I could be in a school in the morning, I could be in a workplace in the afternoon, and in the evening I could be with a community group or, you know, visiting somewhere really unusual like a public service or the Garda College. So our aim is to really try and mainstream that understanding. So it means that me and my team would travel a huge amount, and, you know, no 2 days look the same, which is part of what makes the job interesting, because certainly perhaps somewhat ironically it definitely pushes you outside of your comfort zone all of the time,
but
it also lets you see parts of society that you may never see, and try and, I suppose, move the conversation of autism beyond just that concept of services towards that idea of citizens living in the community.
So you're working very hard.
Yeah, it's really busy. We're going through a major expansion as we kind of go into our second decade of activity, and it's a particularly busy time of the year. It's World Autism Month, so I suppose this is our opportunity to connect with communities across Ireland and build that understanding. I suppose sometimes we've put such an emphasis in society on just access, because autistic people have to fight so hard for that. But what we don't maybe think about is we haven't actually changed how things work to make them accessible. So even if we look at our education system, whereby yes, there's a fight to secure a school place, but then there's still no mandatory training in autism for teachers.
Right.
So that outreach piece is really, really important, and it you know, challenges us every day.
When you're travelling around, obviously that's another sensory experience, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Do autistic people drive? Are they okay with that sort of experience?
So I don't drive. Lots of people do. So no two autistic people are the same, but I would kind of not be the most coordinated person in the world, not the most consistent concentration. So it's probably good for everybody that I use public transport. But I suppose from my perspective, one of the things that is interesting for me in terms of public understanding of autism is the whole area of stimming. So I would walk a lot, you know, from one meeting to another in and around Dublin and so on. And one of the ways that I stay regulated is by stimming.
And explain stimming to people.
Yeah, so stimming is any repetitive action that an autistic person does in order to stay regulated. So while people are listening to this interview, perhaps they're fidgeting in one way or another, and we all do that. And perhaps stimming is sometimes a more obvious and more important form of fidgeting. So it's just like the fan in the computer. It's what keeps the system regulated. So, you know, when I've been sitting for too long, when I'm excited, when I'm worried, when I'm deep in my own thoughts, I'll begin to stim. And if I'm sitting in a chair, that will look like me beginning to bounce in the chair. If I'm walking, which is the more common one, you will see me run quite erratically up the street on my tiptoes. I've no decision as to when I want to do that. So I can't say
it just happens.
Now is the time. It just happens. But I feel a huge release of energy. It's a really positive experience, and it helps me kind of calm down and reconnect. The challenge is when you're a younger child, perhaps people don't pay too much heed, or at least you'd hope not. When you're a 30-year-old man, people stare all the time.
That's right.
People comment, people take pictures. And for me, that's useful for my work because it shows the journey we still need to travel in terms of public attitudes.
Does that still happen to you?
Oh, yeah. On a weekly basis, you would see people take pictures, mimic, comment. Doesn't bother me, but it would be enough to make... Oh, yeah, very much so. On the street, you'd see, you know...
Random people on the street.
Oh, yeah, and pointing out and so on. And that's enough to make autistic people feel unsafe. It's obviously very humiliating. It's something that autistic people need to be able to do in order to feel safe within our society. And yet the reality is many people don't, you know. We poll public attitudes to autism every year, and what we see is that gap between what people want to do and think they know and how they apply that to day-to-day situations. And you know, in our last Same Chance report, which is kind of our state of the community report, 40% of autistic people said they didn't feel safe when out and about in their community. So there's still a huge amount of work to be done to break down those barriers so people can. And I think it's particularly important as we see more and more autistic people aging out of our school system. 1 in 20 children in school now have an autism diagnosis. And I think it's really important that people can feel that, you know, they can be out and about in their own community.
How do you cope with that when someone starts mimicking or doing something like that randomly in public?
I don't think it's a pleasant experience, but for me, it's something that I'm very used to. And I try and take a positive from it, which is I try and say, well, that actually shows us the work that we still need to do. It's real-time market research is how I try and approach it. But it obviously is an unpleasant experience. And for some autistic people, it can be enough to make people feel really unsafe. You know, it starts in school and it works the way up. And that's kind of what the name of our charity is about, because, you know, the reality is autism is an invisible difference. In our communities across the country, there are people who don't have a diagnosis and there are people who, you know, don't want to share their experiences. The only way we can build a society that's inclusive is that when we see people, you know, interacting with their world differently, that we accept people as they are. And that's the really important message going into this World Autism Month.
Adam Harris, founder and CEO of As I Am, this week's visiting critic on Oliver Callan's show. And that's all we have time for on Friday's Playback Daily. So from me, Louise Herity, thanks for listening and have a great weekend.